From New Orleans, Columbia brings you the keynote speech of William Green, president of the American Federation of Labor, who is attending the 64th Annual Convention, now in session. Mr. Green will outline organized labor's war and post-war objectives.
The delegates who have come here from every section of the country for the 64th Annual Convention of the American Federation of Labor represent 7 million loyal and hardworking members of America's Army of Production. They are moved by one sincere and supreme purpose, and that is to defeat the totalitarian tyrants in the shortest time possible and to establish lasting peace based upon social and economic justice throughout the world. To achieve our objectives, we know that we must obtain unity in America, unity of purpose and unity of action that will cement us together in an unconquerable crusade to win the peace as well as the war. The members of the American Federation of Labor will continue to serve in the Army of Production, supplying our brave men in the armed forces with everything they need for final and complete victory over the enemies of America. In token of that determination, I confidently predict that this convention will renew labor's no-strike pledge for the duration. Within the next few days, men occupying highly important positions in the government and leaders of our Army and Navy will come before the convention and testify to the great production achievements of labor on the home front. As an example of how the services of American workers are appreciated by the nation's war leaders, I would like to read to you now a brief cablegram I have just received from the matchless military genius who is now leading our soldiers to victory in the Philippines, General Douglas MacArthur. Here is what he says. Nothing has been more impressive in the mighty war now raging than the magnificent effort of the mass of American labor. It has not failed us in the past. I am supremely confident it will not fail us in the future. We of labor deeply appreciate this salute from General MacArthur, as well as the tributes to the nation's workers which were presented to the convention today by General Somerville and General George Marshall, Chief of Staff of the United States Army. We want them to know, as we want every citizen of our country to know, that labor is prepared to give even greater and more efficient service in the critical months ahead to speed the day of victory. But the delegates to this convention realize that in addition to our war responsibilities, we are now face to face with many serious post-war problems. We know it will be too dangerous to postpone these problems until the fighting ends. They must be tackled and solved now if we hope for peace and security and a good life for the American people in the post-war period. First of all, the men and women of labor, fired by a deep desire for peace, demand that the United Nations shall work out a program that will substitute international cooperation for international outlawry and aggression for all time. This must be the last world war. Labor is seeking full representation at the peace conference to make certain that these paramount demands of our people are heard and heeded. Secondly, we seek economic security in post-war America. We recognize the difficulties involved in passing from a wartime to a peacetime economy. Resolutely, we face the fact that we have to undergo a period of unemployment while industries change over from war production to civilian production. But we insist that this period be made as brief as possible and that no effort be spared to prevent real and widespread suffering. The nation owes that man that much, at least, to its loyal army of production soldiers, and it owes even more to the millions of young men in uniform who will come home from the fighting fronts. They must not be doomed to undergo the pangs and the pains of unemployment again, as they did after the last war. And so we are urging, and will urge at this convention, that immediate steps be taken, preliminary steps at least, for the purpose of bringing about a speedy reconversion. That will involve the disposition of surplus goods. It will also involve the cancellation of contracts. Surely we understand the situation well enough to know that we can't postpone consideration of these problems until the last gun is fired and until the last enemy has surrendered. Good judgment tells us we can begin now and should begin now to bring about reconversion wherever it will not interfere with the war effort. After the war, we insist that work opportunities shall be created and provided for all. During the recent political campaign, we heard much about that. We are practical people. We know the difficulties that will be encountered. But we still believe that if we will diligently and assiduously concentrate our efforts within a reasonable length of time after the war is over, we can provide work opportunities here in our beloved land for all who are willing and able to work. In my opinion, once we have crossed the bridge back to peace and normal times, we will enjoy a period of unusual industrial activity. There will be turned loose a tremendous pent-up demand for civilian goods, a demand that will probably exceed, for the moment, our ability to produce and supply. That demand must be kept alive if we are to attain and maintain full production, which in turn is necessary to create full employment. And common sense tells us that the only way to keep the demand for goods high is to keep the purchasing power of our people high. There, in a nutshell, is the chief economic justification for a high-wage economy, without which American industry and agriculture cannot prosper or grow. But there are other compelling reasons for immediate action to lift the nation's wage levels. First, the efficiency of the individual worker has gone way up during the war period. Let me quote one example. Production of a four-motor bomber, which used to take 200,000 man-hours, now requires only 13,000 man-hours of labor, an increase in efficiency of 93%. This is true all the way down the line in industry. Secondly, we all understand that the government today is industry's biggest customer, and in some lines, its exclusive customer. This condition will end when the war is won. Then industry and agriculture will have to depend upon the American people to buy their products. In order to buy enough, our people must earn enough. It is estimated by the United States Department of Commerce that we must build a national income of at least $140 billion a year in order to keep America on a sound and prosperous level. The national income of America must be kept high in the post-war period for another vital reason. During the war, the national debt has of necessity reached unprecedented proportions. That debt must be paid off if the soundness of the American dollar is to be maintained. Even if it is impossible to start reducing the debt immediately, its very existence constitutes a heavy and continuous burden in interest payments alone. Surely none of us wishes to see the credit of America impaired to the slightest degree. But how can the government derive sufficient money to meet annual interest payments on the debt if the national income is not high enough to yield sufficient tax revenues? To obtain funds, the government must depend on taxes. If the national income is high, the government can obtain large revenues even at a low tax rate. But if the national income falls below $140 billion a year, taxes will have to be kept high, and the wellsprings of our economy will be dried up. In making these plans, it is our purpose not only to protect labor's interests, but to assist and protect the men serving in the armed forces of the nation, among whom are more than 1.5 million members of the American Federation of Labor. We are immovably determined that these brave men who have sacrificed their personal opportunities to serve their country in its time of crisis shall be brought home as soon as possible after the last gun is fired and the last enemy soldier surrenders. That is America's solemn obligation. And when they come back, we insist that the servicemen shall be given every opportunity to return to their old jobs or to make a new start in life. America can do no less for her courageous defenders. In addition, labor solidly supports legislation to provide ex-servicemen with social security, social insurance, and wide opportunities for continued education or for going into business. But there is one more matter to which I must refer: the division which still exists within the ranks of labor. The war perhaps has minimized the effect of that division, but once it ends, labor again may be split into fighting camps, berating each other and attempting to destroy each other. Therefore, I sound this warning now. Just as surely as the sun shines, labor will pay a heavy penalty in the post-war period if the division in its ranks continues. But if there ever was a time when labor in America should be united, it is now, and in the months to come. For that compelling reason, I publicly renew the appeal of the American Federation of Labor to those who left us to come back to the home of labor and reunite with us. But regardless of what course others may take, we in this convention will do everything in our power to strengthen and maintain the free and democratic principles upon which our trade union movement was founded. And after we have considered our problems and debated the issues, we will go out from here, back to our homes and our jobs, united more firmly than ever before to carry out the decisions of the convention and to help America triumph in the war and in the peace.
You have just heard William Green, president of the American Federation of Labor, giving a condensed version of his keynote speech made earlier today at the opening session of the American Federation of Labor's 64th Annual Convention in New Orleans. This broadcast was presented as another of Columbia's features, designed to keep you informed on all sides of matters of public interest. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.